Romans 5:12-5:21, the eighth talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on November 16, 2004, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College.
The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
So far, in the book of Romans, after the introduction, he introduced the gospel by talking about the problem that mankind has. The problem that mankind has is that they are under the wrath of God. They're subject to one day being destroyed at the judgment, punished at the judgment due to their sinfulness and their moral unworthiness. Contrary to the perspective of Phariseeism in his day, that form of Judaism that was popular in his day, we can't somehow gain God's approval by keeping the commandments of the law, because the nature of those commandments are such that part of what's included in the commandments of the Mosaic Covenant is a moral vision that we be good like God is good. And while the Mosaic Covenant itself made provision for our failure in that regard with a series of offerings, guilt offerings and sin offerings and that sort of thing, while there is provision for that, those guilt offerings don't make us worthy of God. They only make us citizens in good standing in Israel, in the nation of Israel. So one can keep the covenant without being worthy in God's eyes. And the mistake the Pharisees made was to think that if it was good enough to make you a citizen, it was good enough to make you worthy in God's eyes. And that's what Paul says is false. That's not the case. That if we are really going to stand at the final judgment and be approved by God, we would have to be good as God is good, and there ain't nobody going to do that. So we have this huge problem, unless God is simply merciful. And that's the good news of the gospel then, that in the first few chapters he proclaims, and that is that God has determined to be good. Jesus, as a high priest, has gone before God and offered up a very costly propitiatory offering, namely his own death, in offering to appeal to God for mercy on our behalf. And anyone who wants mercy from God and who looks to Jesus as their high priest and looks to his offering as an appeal for mercy will receive it. And that's the good news of the gospel. Before that, he says, am I making this up? Am I just some mad rabbi who invented this idea? No, he says, it's actually completely consistent with the teaching of Torah, of the Old Testament, and that's what he looked at in what's traditionally chapter 4. And in the first part of chapter 5, he says, so what? Given that we stand acceptable, in God's eyes, by virtue of the fact that we have believed that Jesus is the Messiah, he is that high priest, he has offered up this offering in our regard. We who believe and now stand approved by God, so what? And the so what is, it turns us into a really special group of people who stand one day to inherit the glory of God, who can now boast in our tribulations, find significance in our tribulations here and now, and know that we have a unique and special standing with God. So we are, out of the sea of humanity, we are numbered among a few people who have this unique relationship with God. Well, that's where he left us in section 8, and now we enter into section 9. In the next section, and it's actually going to be part 2 of the letter, he turns a corner and begins a whole new section of the letter in the section we'll look at next week. And in that part, he begins to answer a series of questions, or actually a series of objections, that a typical Pharisaical Jew would raise against his gospel. So with this section, he's going to finish the initial part of the letter, namely his initial explanation of what the gospel is. He's going to finish that today. Well, the way he finishes it is to recap it, to sort of summarize what it is that he's been talking about. But it's a kind of a unique kind of summary. Every now and then, in a creative moment, if you wrote a paper in school or something, it occurred to you that one way to end your paper, one way to bring, to sum it up and draw a conclusion, is not to go over the same ground again, but to look at it from a completely different angle and capture exactly what you were saying from an entirely different approach. That's what Paul is going to do here. He's going to cover exactly the same ground that he's been looking at throughout the whole early part of the letter, but he's going to approach it from an entirely different angle now. And how is he going to approach it? I would liken it to a cameraman panning back, is that what they call it? Zooming out away from human history, and zooming way, way out, so far out that all the details of human history are basically become invisible, and only two things remain. The two most significant things in all of human history are the only thing that remain visible from the vantage point at which he's going to look at this thing, namely Adam and Jesus. In all of human history, the purposes of God and the content of the gospel and the significance of the gospel can be summed up in this man Adam and the significance of his existence, and this man Jesus and the significance of his existence. So it's basically nothing but the gospel that he's going to sum up here, but he's doing so in a way that he hasn't approached yet in the letter. So let's look at this then. Graph 32. So then, just as through one man sin entered into the world and death through sin, and in this way death spread to all men because all sinned. Now up to the time of the covenant, sin was in fact in the world. Sin does not go on one's record when there is no covenant, but death nevertheless reigned from Adam to the time of Moses, even upon those who had not sinned in the likeness of Adam's transgression, he who was the prototype of what was about to come. But it is not the case that as the transgression, so also the gift. For if by the transgression of the one man, the many died, much more certainly did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus the Christ, prevail with respect to the many. The gift is not in fact like what arises through the transgression of the one, for on the one side, the judgment arises from one transgression that leads to condemnation, but on the other side, the gracious gift is in answer to many transgressions that lead to that judgment. So if by the transgression of the one death reigned through that one, much more certainly did those receiving the prevailing grace, the prevailing gift of dikaiosune, reign into life through the one Jesus, the Christ. So then, just as in connection with the one transgression there was condemnation upon all men, so also in connection with the one act of punishment there was dikaiosis leading to life for all men. For just as through the disobedience of the one man the many were classed as sinners, so also through the obedience of the one the many shall be classed as dikaios. Now the covenant came in alongside to the end that transgression might increase, but where sin increased, grace overwhelmingly prevailed, to the effect that just as sin reigned into death, so also grace might reign into eternal life in light of the dikaiosune that comes through Jesus the Christ, our Lord. Now, for us in the 21st century now, the message of this passage is not at all profound, if you really boil it down to its essence. Or at least it doesn't strike us as profound, I should say. And the reason it doesn't strike us as profound is because you could sum up the message of this passage in a sentence that we use as graffiti all along this land, all across this land. The message could be summed up as Jesus saves. And in the 21st century, that has become a familiar idea. But in the context of this letter, to appreciate what Paul is doing here, we have to recognize how radical and profound this claim is in the context in which he's writing. In the context in which he's writing, the Pharisees probably would have said, the law saves. What has God done to address the problem of mankind and to give us an out, a way of escape from the wrath of God? He gave us the law. And all we have to do is keep the law, and therein we can secure our salvation. So their focus would have been in a completely different place. And the idea that it has anything to do with Jesus would have been absolutely revolutionary. So while on the surface the point of this section is pretty familiar, we need to appreciate its profundity in the context of Paul's argument here as he writes the letter. He begins, "So then, just as through one man sin entered into the world and death through sin, and in this way death spread to all men because all sinned," and then I would argue that he never finishes the sentence. He just cuts it off there. I think paragraph 34 is where he gets around once again. After having interrupted his thought, he comes back to it again in 34 and finishes making the point that he started to make in 32 but never really finished. So if you want to look at 34, it's just, he's talking about, it's his way of describing these two individuals and their lives and their existence and the significance of their existence for the history of mankind, the history of the cosmos even. There's two people. There's one man who brought about the problem that needs to be solved, and there's one man, the hero, the savior, who solved the problem. It really boils down to nothing less than that. And that's what he's saying in 34. "So then, just as in connection with the one transgression of Adam, there was condemnation upon all men, so also in connection with the one act of punishment, there was dikaiosis leading to life for all men. One man, Jesus, brought the condemnation. One man, Adam, brought the condemnation. One man, Jesus, brought about the justification that leads to life. For just as through the disobedience of the one man, Adam, the many were classed as sinners, so also through the obedience of the one, Jesus, the many shall be classed as dikaios." That's very simply the point he set out to make in 32. But he interrupted that. "I'm going to come back and talk about in what sense did sin and death enter the world through Adam. I'll come back to that." But he starts by saying, "As through one man, Adam, sin entered into the world and death through sin, and in the way death spread, and in this way death spread to all men because all sinned." Then he interrupts himself, I think, because he made the claim because all sinned, and he realizes there's a potential problem with that claim, so he goes on to explain. "Now, up to the time of the covenant," most of your translations will translate that "law," but I translate it "covenant" because I'm convinced that he has in view there the Mosaic law when he says that. So I translate it "covenant" to distinguish the Mosaic law from just law in general. "Up to the time of the Mosaic covenant, sin was in fact in the world. Sin does not go on one's record when there is no covenant, but death nevertheless reigned from Adam to the time of Moses, even upon those who had not sinned in the likeness of Adam's transgression." Now, what's his point, and why is he saying it? His point is that if you look at Adam, and then you look at the Jews in the time of Moses, you see something that they have in common. Adam was giving an explicit, unambiguous commandment, instruction from God, and he acted, his actions flew in the face of that. I mean, he transgressed an explicit commandment by God. In the time of Moses, God came and in a spectacular kind of way gave a series of commandments and ordinances and instructions to Israel that were explicit, and the Jews once again transgressed that. Their actions flew in the face of those instructions. They disobeyed an explicit commandment of God once again. In the intervening time, you have generation after generation of people who had not disobeyed explicit commandments of God in the same way that Adam did and people following Moses did. Now, if you are as focused on the law as the Pharisees were, it seems reasonable to me that even if they didn't articulate it in so many words, their sort of implicit understanding of the nature of sin was sin is to transgress a commandment of God. The implication of that, of course, is those people from the time of Adam until Moses were not really sinners in the same sense that Adam was and in the same sense that people following Moses were. They hadn't disobeyed the commandment of God. And if they hadn't disobeyed the commandment of God, perhaps there was nothing, they had done nothing wrong. If you so equate doing something wrong with transgressing the law, then it would be easy to think that they had done nothing wrong since they had transgressed no law. That's the very thing that Paul wants to challenge. He wants to disabuse them of the notion that the only way you can do something wrong is through transgression. You may not transgress an explicit commandment of God and still be very, very wrong. And the way he makes the point is by saying the people from Adam until Moses, death reigned in their lives just as surely as it did in the life of Adam and from Moses and following. And if death reigns, there's only one reason why death reigns. It's because the wrath of God is over them because they are in the wrong. Their lives are not right. So Paul is actually challenging what I'm guessing would have been a prevailing, if implicit, nonetheless prevailing view among the Jews, and that is you can define sin in relationship to the law. Sin is not in relationship to the law. Sin is in relationship to the goodness of God. And all of mankind has some sort of rational and intuitive access to that. Our problem is not that we don't know the difference between right and wrong. Our problem is that we don't do the right that we know is right. We know what we shouldn't do. We know how we shouldn't behave, but we behave that way anyway. Jesus made that appeal, if you remember, in the famous golden rule. He's basically saying, you figure it out. You want to know what's right? Well, just stop and think about it. How would you like to be treated? Well, don't treat other people in a way that you wouldn't want to be treated. It's not that difficult. We know that as a rule of thumb, that's going to tell us what the right thing to do is. We don't need divine revelation to know that. Rationality itself is sufficient to tell us that that's the right thing to do. Our problem is not a lack of knowledge. Our problem is a lack of will, a lack of desire, a lack of commitment to love and goodness and truth. And that's our problem. So even though God had not explicitly commanded mankind anything during that time, nevertheless, they were disobedient to the goodness of God. Their lives did not conform to the goodness of God, and their lives were subject to death, the judgment of God, the wrath of God. He makes this strange comment here, even upon those who had not sinned in the likeness of Adam's transgression. I already explained what that is, an explicit commandment of God they hadn't transgressed. And then he says, he who was the prototype of what was about to come. If you're looking at another translation, many of them are going to say, he who was a type of him who was to come, and the him will often be capitalized. What lies behind that translation is a not unpopular perspective on biblical interpretation called typology. It was very fashionable a couple of generations ago, and you still see it being employed by Bible teachers today. I'm a little isolated, so I don't know how popular it is these days, but I know in my early training it was very, very, very popular and much practiced. Typology was a view that one of the primary purposes of the Old Testament was to see embedded in the history and the religious institutions and the events that happened in the Old Testament a kind of symbolic representation of the gospel, the life of Christ, the office of Christ, and various aspects of our theology of Christ. So, for example, I remember reading a commentary that was looking at the account of Joshua taking the people into the promised land and capturing Jericho, and the spies go in before that, and they are hidden by the prostitute Rahab, and if my memory serves me rightly, she allows them to escape by letting them down the outside of the city wall with a rope. But the rope is scarlet in color. And many Bible teachers have looked at that and said, there you go. You see, there's a foreshadowing of the blood of Jesus. You know, why else would the rope be scarlet? I mean, that's just one of hundreds of examples that could be given of where Bible teachers have looked at various details in the historical account and seen, I would argue, invented analogs between that detail and something in the life of Christ, and then argued that it's what they call a type. That was a type of Christ there in the Old Testament. it's not that there aren't things in the Old Testament that do symbolically foreshadow truths about Jesus. That is true. That happens. But the amount and number and extent to which people will go to find those is, I think, a fallacious way of looking at the Old Testament. I think what motivates it primarily is a kind of apologetic motive. That is, their thinking is, multiply that hundreds of times or thousands of times so that you find just literally hundreds of examples of the Old Testament foreshadowing Jesus. Then you can plausibly make the claim, look what a miraculous book the Bible is. Look how amazing that is, that there's all these things in the Old Testament that foreshadow Jesus. How could you possibly deny that it's inspired after seeing that? Well, the problem is, it's a trickery of statistics, one, and it's mistaking discovery for invention. If you go looking for an analog in the life of Jesus for some detail of the text in the Old Testament, I guarantee you, you'll find it. You're smart, you're imaginative, you're creative, you're inventive. You're gonna find it if you go looking for it. But finding it doesn't mean it was there, because there's two ways to find it. You can find what's actually there, and you can invent what's not there. And most typology, I would argue, is inventing what's not there. Well, anyway, in any case, translating it, it was a type of him who was to come, obviously, I think, a reference to Jesus, as indicated by the capital letter. They're arguing, see, Paul's talking about that. Paul's talking about Adam being a type of Jesus. But in this context, why would that make any sense? I mean, how would that advance his point? How would that advance his argument? How would that in any way support the theological claim that he's making here by just making this offhanded observation that Adam was a type of Christ? I mean, I don't know what to do with that. Even if Adam is a type of Christ, okay, so? What does that have to do with the point that he's making? The word that they translate type, tupos, in Greek, is oftentimes translated example, and can mean just an example of something, or in this case, an example in the way of being what we would call a prototype, I think, which makes a whole lot more sense in this context. What he's saying is, what was about to come was Adam Jr., and Adam Jr., Jr., and Adam Jr., 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 and so forth. I mean, what was about to come was the whole human race. Adam was the prototype of the little human critters who were going to come into being and people human history from here on out. Adam's transgression, therefore, is significant because everyone who was about to come into being was going to be a chip off the old block. Adam's transgression was an indication, was a pointer to their nature just as much as it was a pointer to his nature, because he was their prototype. He was a human being. He was the prototypical human being. And we see in Adam what human beings are. He was a transgressor. And if he was a transgressor, so was everyone who followed him. He was someone who fell short of the glory of God. And if he fell short of the glory of God, then so would everyone who descended from him. Well, you can see why I translate it that way. That's totally relevant to the point that he's making in a way that the other one would not be, I think. Okay, so that's why everybody between Adam and Moses were transgressors, if you will, even if they didn't transgress, because they were born of Adam, who is a prototype for every one of them. Okay, then in this next section, having interrupted the main point he was going to make, he decides to continue the interruption a little bit by making a point of comparison between Adam and his transgression and Jesus and the gift that comes in connection with Jesus. He wants to make an important comparison. But it is not the case that as the transgression, so also the gift. In other words, there's an important disanalogy between Adam and Jesus, between the transgression and the gift, an important respect in which they're different. For if by the transgression of the one man, the many died, much more certainly did the grace of God and the gift by the grace of the one man, Jesus the Christ, prevail with respect to the many. I think the operative term that's carrying the weight of his assertion here is what I translated prevail. Again, if you have other English translations, they will probably tend to translate it abound to the many, which is fine. I mean, that is what it means. But I think to understand the point that he's making, we have to understand that when something abounds in certain contexts, it's more than enough to get the job done. And one of the ways that we would translate that is with the word prevail, and that's what I've chosen to do here. The point that he's making is you really have two realities at work. In the case of Adam, you have the justice of God and the judgment of God. And that's reflective of an important aspect of who God is. God is a good God. God is a just God. God does not ultimately tolerate evil. He does not tolerate ungodliness. He does not tolerate the ingratitude of his creatures toward him. He sees that as being unjust, and he will act to rectify justice. That's one aspect of the God that we're dealing with. The other aspect of the God that we're dealing with is God's mercy. God is a merciful God, and as a merciful God, he is willing to forbear and to be patient, and ultimately in that mercy, he's willing to entirely overlook my sin, my ingratitude, my unworthiness, and all that is wrong about me. God in his mercy will overlook all that. But Paul wants to make an incredibly important point here. Those are two equally a part of the character of God. But at the heart of the good news is this mercy prevails over God's judgment. God's mercy in the end will always trump his judgment. The way James put it, said in the letter of James, explicitly he makes a statement, mercy triumphs over judgment. That's, I think, exactly the point Paul is making here, except he calls it grace. It's grace that prevails over condemnation. So in that respect, you know, that's the profound essence of the gospel, really, is that there's a disanalogy between the reality brought into place by Adam and the reality brought into place by Jesus. The one doesn't just sort of bring us back to ground zero and cancel each other out or vie with each other in some kind of dynamic tension. Mercy just flat out wins in the mind of God over his judgment. Then he goes on to make a second point where they are not analogous. The gift is not in fact like that, like what arises through the transgression of the one. For on the one side, the judgment arises from one transgression that leads to condemnation. But on the other side, the gracious gift is an answer to many transgressions that lead to that judgment. Okay, some of your translations there that lead to maybe righteousness. But I think they're misconstruing what Paul means by that word there. Judgment, I think, is more appropriate there. Here's his point. It's a very, very interesting and profound argument. Take some serial killer who goes out and murders 25 people and, say, gets convicted and is then sentenced to 25 years of life in prison to be served consecutively. I mean, I always smile and laugh at that kind of sentence. I know there's a legal reason for it, but I still can't help but chuckle at that. You're going to be in prison for life and serve 25 times consecutively. This is a Hindu judge. But it reflects a very, very important truth, and that is any one of those transgressions, any one of those evil deeds, any one of those actions that man committed got him life in prison or even death, the death penalty, deservedly. So 25 times he deserves this sentence. I think that's what Paul is saying here. The gift is not in fact like that, like what arises through the transgression of the one. For on the one side, the judgment of God arises from one transgression that leads to condemnation. Wait, so the judgment arises from one transgression, leads to condemnation. But on the other side, the gracious gift is an answer to many transgressions that lead to that judgment. Okay. When God comes along and overlooks my transgressions and my mercy, his mercy knows no bounds. It knows no limits. I may deserve condemnation, not for one transgression, but for, I don't know, I haven't counted, but thousands, tens of thousands of transgressions in my life. I mean, I stopped counting a while ago. We deserve eternal destruction many, 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 many times over. And the grace of God was abundant enough to look past, overlook, be merciful, and forgive every one of them. I mean, it's like forgiving all 25 murderers of the mass murderer, not just one. And yet, on the other hand, God's justice is proportionate, it's measured, and it's fair. It's equitable. God doesn't give us anything we don't deserve in the condemnation that we are subject to. So it's an important disanalogy between the reality of condemnation and the reality of God's mercy and God's grace. Not only does God's mercy trump God's grace, but God's mercy knows no bounds. God's judgment is always merely equitable and proportionate and fair. God is not unbounded in his wrath and his anger and his fury against sin. It's always proportionate. A very, very important truth to understand the nature of God. So that's the other thing Paul wants to be clear that we understand. And then he sums that up in sentence 3. So if by the transgression of the one, death reigned through the one, much more certainly did those receiving the prevailing grace, the prevailing gift of dikaiosune, reign into life through the one, Jesus the Christ. I don't have an answer to there's a question about that that I don't have an answer to. The first one, death reigned through that one, I understand that. When we talk about something reigning supreme, I think we just mean it's the prominent reality, the reality that's prevailing somehow. Through Adam, death is the prevailing reality in human existence. Through Jesus, dikaiosune, being set right with God and declared acceptable to God, is the reigning reality. But what puzzles me that I don't have an answer to is, why doesn't he say that dikaiosune reigns, just like he said that death reigns? Why does he say that we reign into life through the one Jesus the Christ? And I don't have an answer for that. Maybe you can enlighten me on that. Okay, so that's this important interruption where he qualifies. He wants to say the reality that came into place through Adam is matched by the reality that came through Jesus. There's the one and there's the other. But before he finally gets around to finishing that, he says, but there's an important way, there's two important senses in which the one is not like the other. And we need to understand that as well. So now he finally gets around to his main point to say, but there are these two realities that are corresponding realities to each other. So then, just as in connection with the one transgression, there was condemnation upon all men, so also in connection with the one act of punishment, there was dikaiosis, leading justification, leading to life for all men. For just as through the disobedience of the one man the many were classed as sinners, so also through the obedience of the one the many shall be classed as dikaios. What puzzles a lot of people about this passage is he goes from talking about all men to the many. And let me comment on that. In the first place, by the all men, I think he means all men, literally, every individual human being. In Adam, every individual human being is subject to condemnation. Because of Jesus, every human being has available to him justification leading to life. Now, could you read it that everyone gets saved? You could, but that would be inconsistent with everything else that Paul says everywhere else. What makes more sense here is that through the one act of Jesus, dikaiosis leading to life became a possibility for all of mankind. Every human being has the potential for entering into life through being justified by the act of Jesus. We know from a couple of sections back, Paul was very clear to point out that Jesus' death was a propitiation for those who believe. So he's already qualified it. He's already made it clear that Jesus' act of propitiation, his offering of propitiation, only is operative in my life if I want it to be, if I think it ought to be, if I think I need mercy and I want Jesus to appeal to God for mercy on my behalf, then it is there, then it is a propitiation. But for those, implicitly, for those who don't believe, who don't claim it for their own, then presumably there is no appeal for mercy and we will not receive it. That seems to be the logic of Paul's position. Okay, then in 2, he changes to the many. He used it up in the first sentence of 33 as well. It is not the case that as the transgression, so also the gift. For if by the transgression of the one man, the many died, much more certainly did the grace of God and the gift of by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, prevail with respect to the many. I think this, the many, he's using as a kind of a technical term here for what in a few sections later in the letter he's going to call the elect. That is, that Paul's going to be very clear by the time the letter's over that he believes that we who have believed, who have accepted Jesus' propitiation on our behalf, are among a select group of people who believe because we have first been chosen. The reason I have responded positively to the role of Jesus in my life is because God chose me and drew me to his Son, to acknowledge his Son and to believe in his Son. Well, this is an anticipation of that doctrine, I think. The many are that those people among mankind who have positively responded to this. So he's narrowing his focus. All men were condemned. Life was made available through justification to all men. Let's look at the elect, the many. All of them were condemned to life because of their relationship with Adam. All of them reign in life, to eternal life, through Jesus. I will comment in 34, there's another translation where place where my translation varies from more typical translations. I have, so also in connection, this is in the first sentence, so also in connection with the one act of punishment, there was dikaiosis leading to life for all men. That is, the act of punishment was Jesus being punished on the cross. Punishment is, I'm being a little bit loose and free in my translation there. The way I'm looking at the word, it would be better translated more literally with the one act of being sentenced or being condemned. There was dikaiosis leading to life for all men. I think what Paul is saying is, in what happened to Jesus, the condemnation that I deserved was put on Jesus. So Jesus' death on the cross was a kind of punishment. It was a kind of condemnation where my sin was being condemned in Jesus. He says that he will say that explicitly in chapter 8 in a few sections here. And I think that's what he's saying here. Okay. Then in 35, when you read this for the first time, this seems like an incredible non sequitur. You know, you're going along and you're following him and you understand his argument, and then he says, and the law. And you go, well, who was talking about the law or the covenant? Where is this coming from? I think it's related to what I mentioned earlier. He knows his culture. He knows his context. He knows the nature of the objections that are going to be raised to his teaching. Jesus has been saying, there's Adam, and he represents the problem, and there's Jesus, and he represents our salvation from the problem. Well, any good Pharisee of that time is going to say, Paul, what about the law? We always put the law in that role, so if you're right, and Jesus is the solution to the problem that's brought in with Adam, then what's the relevance of the law? What are we supposed to do with that? So he feels the need to answer that, because he's dethroned the law from its place of importance in the minds of the Jews of his day. So what about the covenant? Well, the covenant came in alongside to the end that transgression might increase. But where sin increased, grace overwhelmingly prevailed, to the effect that just as sin reigned into death, so also grace might reign into eternal life in light of the dikaiosune that comes through Jesus the Christ our Lord. There he's just repeating what he's been saying all along. But the part that's new is that the purpose of the covenant, he's saying, was to the end that transgression might increase. Okay, what's he saying? There are many Bible teachers, when I was first being taught the Bible, a very stock interpretation of a passage like this. We're going to run into a similar claim in a few more sections where he's going to deal with it in a lot more detail, and we'll look at it more carefully there. But a stock interpretation of this kind of claim is that the law actually provokes my sinfulness. It actually stimulates my sinfulness somehow. And the example that I remember hearing is if you're walking down the street and you see the sign that says do not step on the grass, that you get this irresistible urge to step on the grass. Well, my problem is I've seen signs that say do not step on the grass, and frankly, I just kept walking. I mean, I didn't have an irresistible urge to step on the grass. I think what makes that plausible is we know all too well the scenario where some obnoxious person who is making a pretense to authority that I don't believe they have and certainly don't deserve, like some uppity gardener, for example, who tells me don't step on the grass, then I feel an irresistible urge to step on the grass. That's true. I mean, that's a very real phenomenon where some authority figure who doesn't really have a right to tell me what to do presumes to do so, and that riles me up and gets me angry, and I feel compelled to disobey them. But that's not my experience with the law of God. My experience with the law of God is not that I want to show God a thing or two and I want to tell him who's boss. My problem with the law of God is I agree that it's good. I agree that it's right. I think it would be wonderful I could keep it. I just don't do it. And that's what he's going to argue in a few more sections. That's my problem, is that there's this war that rages within me, and I'm torn. With my mind, I agree with the law that it's good, but there's this other principle at work in me that makes me disobey the very law that I myself am willing to call good. So what is he talking about then? In what sense does the transgression increase? Well, what he's going to argue later in the letter is it increases in the sense that my consciousness of it, my awareness of it, is heightened. See, before God comes along and gives me a reason to conform my life to godliness, I can always just sit back and say to myself, yeah, it would be good to be good. I think I'll do that one day. I think I'll do that. And because we don't have any resolve to do it, and we haven't been given any motive to make a resolve to do it, we can always chalk up my lack of goodness to just not trying, to just not being interested enough, to just not being motivated enough. But I don't see it as a problem with me. I don't see it that there's any lack of goodness in me. I just think I haven't been trying. Well, then the covenant comes along and gives me a reason to try. And what Paul is thinking is for the Jews, that's what God did. He gave them a reason to be obedient. Do this and you will live and prosper in the land. Don't do this and I will judge you. Okay, now that's motive. That's a motivation to keep the law. And yet, with all the motivation that's implicit in that, you need to do it, they still didn't do it. Well, now what do we chalk my transgression up to? It's not trying. It's not lacking reason. It's not lacking motivation. It comes to the realization that there's something broken inside of me. There's something wrong with me. There's something deficient. And my awareness of my own sinfulness then becomes heightened and becomes increased. So with the increased transgression comes the heightened awareness of individual human sinfulness. And that, he's arguing, was why God gave the covenant. I'm running out of time, so I don't want to dwell on this, but especially academic sorts totally misunderstand this, I think. Paul is not saying here, this is the reason for the Mosaic covenant. I mean, I know you could read it that way and it might sound like that. The covenant came in alongside it and that transgression might increase. But Paul is not. I mean, Paul's read the Torah. I mean, he's not stupid. He knows that the covenant was given for very complex reasons that have to do with promises to Abraham and the faithfulness of God and a whole story and a whole drama that was going to be played out between God and a special people that God had chosen for himself. and the covenant was an integral part of that story and that drama. Well, Paul knows that, certainly. But I think what Paul is answering is, why did the covenant take the form that it did? God could have, for example, only included things in the covenant that amounted to dress funny and eat funny. You know, be a really weird people in this particular way. I mean, that was part of the covenant. Be a peculiar people by what you eat, by what you wear, by how you conduct your religion and your lives externally. But he didn't stop at that. He also went one step further and said, and furthermore, you are commanded to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. You are to be holy as God is holy. You are to be godlike in your moral character. Ah, there's the rub. It's easy to eat funny and dress funny, but being good is really, really impossible for us. And yet that's a part of the covenant, and I think what Paul is recognizing is it's that part of the covenant that God put in that way and put in that form in order to serve as a mirror so that we could see who we are morally and come to self-knowledge about ourselves as sinners and morally broken creatures. If the law had not said be good, we would not know that about ourselves in the same way as we do having confronted the law. I want to deal with about four theological issues here that are related to this passage, and then I'll open it up for your questions. First of all, back to the first assertion in 32, so then, just as through one man sin entered into the world and death through sin, and in this way death spread to all men because all sinned. What's going on there? How did sin enter the world in Adam? I'm going to take issue with a very common Reformed doctrine, and I think some people outside of Reformed circles hold this doctrine as well. The typical Reformed doctrine is that they believe in a doctrine that they call the federal headship of Adam. And if I understand what they mean by that, they understand that Adam was appointed by God to be what they call the federal head of the entire human race. And a federation, as you know, is a group of individuals who get represented in a single institution or a single reality. So the idea is that even though we in mankind are many, we get represented by one individual. And it's God who appointed that individual who is going to represent us, and he appointed the first man, Adam, to be that representative head of the human race. And then they go further. What's the significance of that? The significance of that is in the initial story of the transgression. When Adam chose to disobey God, his choice to disobey God was as my representative and as your representative. He was representing you in that choice. So it's as if God had given him the authority to choose for me and to choose for you. That being the case, so they argue, when Adam transgressed, you and I transgressed. When Adam incurred the guilt of his transgression, he incurred guilt for that transgression for you and for me. So taken to its logical conclusion, no Reformed theologian would say this, but taken to its logical conclusion, if someone, by some weird accident, some weird quirk sneaking below the radar screen of God's sovereignty and creatorship, were to live a sinless and flawless life, this doctrine would say, too bad. Sinless though you may be, you are nonetheless guilty for the sin that Adam committed, because he was your representative, and when he chose for you, and he chose transgression. Bummer. So you stand guilty, even though you as an individual are morally perfect. Now, no Reformed theologian would say you're morally perfect, but that's the logic of their position. And then, therefore, Jesus becomes our federal head in a similar manner when we believe in Jesus, believing in Jesus makes us adopt Jesus, if you will, as our federal head, such that the obedience that Jesus chose when he was similarly tested in this life, he chose obedience, and his obedience and the worthiness that accrues from that obedience then becomes my obedience because he's my representative and he chose for me and he chose obedience. Yay. So they see a kind of symmetry there. Just as I sinned in Adam, I obeyed and acted righteously in Jesus, and it's the latter that trumps the former, of course. Okay, that's the doctrine of moral, of federal headship. I have three problems with that. One is a moral problem. I don't think it's just and fair. It would be different if I chose Adam as my representative and I knew the rules, but that's not the doctrine. The doctrine is not that I chose him. The doctrine is that God appointed him to be my federal head. That may be one thing in legal matters. It's an entirely different thing in moral matters, it seems to me. And I just think that that would be immoral for God to impute to me a guilt that was not mine. My second problem is sort of related to that, but it's kind of a theological problem, and that is, I think God would find that unjust. If you were to look at Deuteronomy 24:16, for example, in Deuteronomy 24:16, one of the statutes and the ordinances that God revealed to Israel was, you shall not put to death a son for the sins of his father, nor a father for the sins of his son. And this is God himself embodying in the law and the covenant that he made with Israel his own sense of justice. It would not be right, it would not be just to punish a son for the sins of the father. Now, I know the federal headship doctrine would have an answer to that, and that is, well, we're not just putting Jack to death for the sins of Adam, his father, we're putting Jack to death for his own sin because Adam's sin was Jack's sin. And they would get around it in that way. But then I have an exegetical problem. Because look at what Paul goes on to argue immediately. Now, up to the time of the covenant, sin was in fact in the world. Sin does not go on one's record when there is no covenant, but death nevertheless reigned from Adam to the time of Moses, even upon those who had not sinned in the likeness of Adam's transgression. Well, by the doctrine of federal headship, who were they? Who could possibly exist under their doctrine who hadn't sinned in the likeness of Adam's transgression? Because according to their doctrine, everyone has sinned in the identity of Adam's transgression. Adam's transgression was their transgression. So of course they've sinned in the likeness of Adam's transgression, every single person on the planet. So who does Paul think he's talking about here? So Paul doesn't seem to know the doctrine of federal headship when he's writing this. That's my third and final problem with that. Instead, I think Paul has a much more straightforward view here. I mean, instead of the doctrine of federal headship, Paul's doctrine is simply that Adam was a sinner. We know Adam was a sinner because when he was given an explicit commandment from God, he transgressed it, demonstrating that he was a sinner. You and I and every person on the planet shares in Adam's nature because we were born of him. We're like him. I mean, the point that I made about him being our prototype. That sin was passed down, and don't ask me how that works. I don't know. But sin was passed down biologically, genetically, somehow. Sin was passed down from parent to child to child to child. And so what we see in Adam is going to also be true about us. So in 32, when he says, so then, just as through one man sin entered into the world and death through sin, and in this way death spread to all men because all sinned, he means that quite literally. Why do you and I stand under the condemnation of death? Because we have sinned. That's why. Why did we sin? Because I'm just like my father, and my father sinned. And why did he sin? Because it goes all the way back to Adam. Adam sinned, and his sinfulness, his tendency to hate God and be ungrateful to God and be rebellious against God. Those tendencies were passed on down from father to child, from the original man, Adam. Second thing I want to comment on is, even though this is the passage that someone like Augustine goes to support the doctrine of the fall, I think it becomes evident when we look at this passage pretty closely that there's no such thing as the fall in this passage. That's a theological invention, born sometime in the Middle Ages. Paul, it seems to me, is teaching something very, very different. I mean, the traditional doctrine of the fall is that God made mankind, Adam and Eve, to be morally perfect beings, morally perfect individuals. And then, lo and behold, they made this momentous choice that not only the effects of which not only involved their own transformation from being morally perfect to being morally depraved, but likewise transformed all of nature with it. And you literally had this falling away from perfection of all of God's creation as a result of this act of the one man and woman. Nowhere is that explicitly taught in the Bible. It's a place like this that they go to it. But in order to see it here, you have to read it into here. In fact, what Paul believes, I think, is that the transgression of Adam was not a momentous event that changed anything. The transgression of Adam was an event that revealed the way things were. Adam transgressed because he was a transgressor, a sinner. He was created a sinner. He was created imperfect. He was created a person in need of redemption. Now, that's not a very popular view, but I'm convinced that it is Paul's perspective here. From the get-go, the whole biblical story is a story of redemption. Creation was a redeeming of the chaos, of the nothingness, into something. But when he created the world, he didn't create it and say, this is good, in the sense of, wow, we're exactly where I want it to be, only to be thwarted by this free will creature, Adam, who threw everything into chaos, and then God had to scramble to fix what he had so right to start with. When God created the heavens and the earth and mankind and the animals and said, this is good, it's good in the way that a cook's broth is good. It's exactly the way he wants it. It's exactly what he set out to create. It's exactly right. And then, having made it exactly right, there begins this unfolding drama of redemption, of further redemption. He's already redeemed the nothingness and made it something, but then the whole history of the cosmos is this continuous drama of taking fallen, deficient, evil, wicked human beings in order to redeem some of them to ultimate perfection, to be citizens of the eternal kingdom of God one day. And we don't really have what God set out to create at the beginning until you get to the end. You don't have it at the beginning in the first chapter. You have it at the end in the last chapter, where God literally destroys this heavens and earth. If it was perfect from the get-go, then why did God slip in the law of entropy into the very fabric of the physics of the universe? I mean, the law of entropy says this world was created to run down and no longer be operative. It had built-in obsolescence into the very physical laws of the physical universe. If it was perfect from the get-go, why did he do that? Now, some people might want to argue, well, the law of entropy wasn't in place until Adam fell, until Adam transgressed. But that doesn't make any sense to me. Because if you have the very fundamental laws of physics being transformed out of a decision that a human being made in his free will, you'd at least have a pop somewhere in the universe. And there's not even a whisper here of any physical transformation of the creation. I mean, at least you get a footnote in the Bible about that, I think, because that would have had to have been a huge event for all of physics to be transformed in the twinkling of an eye. But that's not the story. The story seems to be this very, very continuous story of this man and this woman who were given a commandment not to do something, and they did it, And God said, okay, now you did it. Now you're banished and you're cursed. And this is going to be a longer story here that has to play out. So I just think all the evidence points to the fact, the reality that God created Adam and Eve sinners, created them evil, and they demonstrated that by the test in the garden, and then God gets on with the story that he had intended from the very beginning, the story of redeeming these sinners into glorified human beings one day. I'll call that good, and we'll have your questions or comments.
I'm still confused on how God, being good, if I understand it correctly, would create evil in his creation.
To answer your question, help me understand a little bit more. Why does it seem problematic to you that God would create evil?
I don't know. It just seems, I don't know, theologically, that it doesn't make sense. Okay. It's a contradiction of who God is. He can only be one thing.
Okay. Well, there's two things that I think bother people about that. One, probably this is not what's bothering you about it, but let me address it anyway. Sometimes I think people are inclined to think that in order for God to create something, he needs to create out of what he is, and therefore if God created evil, that would implicate him as being evil, because how could he even come up with evil, if you would, if he wasn't drawing on something that already existed within in him. But I don't think that can be true, because God created stuff and he's not stuff. God created matter and he's not matter. God created the physical material universe and he is in fact spiritual. So there he's creating something that doesn't reflect something of what he is. He's actually creating something that he is not in that case. Presumably, this color on the wall, God created that, but I don't think it's because he is that. You know, presumably God is colorless, and yet he created color. Presumably God is not sound, and yet he created sound. I mean, you just go right on down everything in creation. Most of it's very implausible that the reason he created it is because somehow he contains that within himself. Rather, I think he's just creating something. It may embody something of who he is, but it's different from who he is. It's other than who he is. And I don't think that's a problem for that to be the case, because if it is, all of creation is a problem, it seems to me. The other issue is harder, and that is, if you're good, why would you be bringing about evil? Now, it's important that you make a distinction between creating evil and bringing evil into existence if you're a creator, and doing evil. Those are not the same thing. God has never done evil. He never will do evil. He will never be the agent of an evil action, I would argue. That's what his goodness entails. But could he bring into being creatures who are evil creatures and therefore do evil? That's different. That's a whole other matter. And I would draw an analogy between what God has done in his creation and what a writer of a book does. I could write a novel and create characters in my novel that I hate, because everything about them, everything in their character, everything in their value system is completely abhorrent to me. It goes so much against my own values and my own commitments. I hate them, but I still created them. And I would liken it to that. Now, why would you do that? Why would I write a book like that? Well, presumably, there would be some ultimate redeeming purpose, that the message of my book, that my values would ultimately be reflected in the story of the novel I created. They may not be embodied in that character, but by the time you tell the whole story, and the role that that character plays in the story, and how that character meets its end in the book and so on, now you're going to see me. You're going to see my values. You're going to see my character being embodied. And I would argue the same thing for God. I mean, there are times in the world when we look at the horrible, horrible cruelty and injustice in the world, that you look at that and go, why did you make this place? I mean, wasn't nothing better than this? And you're sorely tempted to draw that conclusion. But at those times, we just need to remember, this is not the end. This is not the last chapter. This is not the whole story. I can't decide whether this was better than nothing until I get to the end and put it all in context and look back on it, and then I can make the judgment, was this worth it or what? And my hope is, my faith as a believer, my confidence is that from the vantage point of the last chapter, I'll look back and go, that was a good creation you did. That was a good gig. But
thank you.
You know, experientially, it's only a hope at this point. It's only my belief, but I haven't experienced it. None of us have experienced that. Does that help?
If God said, don't kill a father's son for the sins of the father, why did he kill Achan's entire family?
Well, that's different. That wasn't justice. That was war. And the question there is the justification for replacing the Canaanites in the land to start with. There is a comment in, where is it, in Genesis. He says, he promises them that he's going to send them down into Egypt and they will be bondage for so many years. But then he's going to take them back into the land and give them the land that he swore to give to their fathers. But there's a comment, but he must wait until the iniquity of the Amorites is complete. And I think I have no idea how they know this, but I've read that the archaeologists have concluded that the Canaanite culture of that time was completely being decimated by venereal disease. It was an incredibly heathen, very, very bloody and grotesque religious practices that they practiced, very promiscuous sexuality and ritualistic sexuality and all kinds of stuff that was going on that was literally destroying the people from the inside. And arguably, God had been patient and forbearing toward these Gentile heathens as well. I don't know how he had warned them, but I suspect that he had even warned them. One of the reasons that Israel had to go and be in bondage in Israel for as long as they did is because he wasn't ready to give them the land yet, because he wanted to wait for the Amorites to have their opportunity to repent. So part of coming in and wiping the Canaanites out of the land and God's what seems like incredibly brutal scorched earth policy that he wanted them to follow, I think had to do with the fact that it was God's divine judgment on the Canaanites.
Could you talk about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?
Anything in particular?
Just how it, what it represents in terms of Adam and Eve and the rest of mankind.
Okay. Well, my view is that it was a tree just like the tree next to it. You know, I don't know what fruit it was, but pomegranate or fig tree or something. And the pomegranates and the figs on that tree of the knowledge of good and, I'm sorry, yeah, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was just the same fruit as was on the tree right next to it that they could freely eat from. I think that's part of what the serpent, the deceiver, was using to deceive Eve, because she looked and she could see that it was good to eat, it says in the text. Well, I'm not necessarily granted, but one possible explanation for how she could look and see that it was good to eat is because she'd been eating from the tree right next to it, and it was the same fruit. So she was puzzled by, I can eat from that one, but I can't eat from that one, even though it's the same fruit. And yet I think that's the choice that she was left with. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, I think, was just a symbol. It was named that because it was going to symbolize the purpose it served in the garden. Namely, it was a test of their character. Are you good or are you evil? This tree is going to know you. This tree is going to find you out, if you will, because God is designating this tree as off limits and then saying, okay, let's see if you will heed my voice and obey my voice. Since they didn't heed his voice, it found them out as evil rather than good. Now, Satan, to takes the label, the title of the tree, and twists it. He says, basically, in effect, now why is this called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Ah, because God knows that in the day that you eat of it, you will become wise like him in knowing good and evil, something like that. Well, that was a lie. I mean, that's a lie out of the mouth of Satan, and that wasn't true. It wasn't magic juice in the fruit. It wouldn't do anything for them or transform them in any way. It was just a fig. And the only significance of that fig was God said, don't eat it. But Satan, in trying to get them to eat it, tells them a story and incites their imagination to imagine that there's something else going on here and that something will be the consequence or the result of eating that. Now, what he tells them is in part true, that is, in the day that they eat of it, they will become as God, knowing good and evil, in the sense that in the day that you eat of that, you will have put yourself in the place of God, being the arbiter of good and evil, and only God has that right, has that role. But you are going to arrogate yourself to the position of God in the day that you eat of that. So it's partially true what he was saying, but not true in the sense that he expected Eve to take it, I think.
Thank you. I'm curious, when you say that that God made Adam and Eve evil from the beginning, or wicked, sinful, use the word sinners. I'm curious about that because in my mind, sinners is tied to a willful act, or like in the way you're describing, it almost makes it an ontological characteristic of them. And so how exactly do you see that a person being made a sinner? In the sense that it seems like you need a volitional act before they become sinners.
Okay, well, partially, see that section we looked at where Paul is actually responding to the Pharisees who are more inclined to define sin as related to a willful act, namely a willful act of disobedience relative to the covenant. Paul wants to say, no, that's not exactly right. Sin, transgression is something that we do, but evil is something we are. It's a proclivity within us. It's some kind of propensity that is in my being, if you will. And I mean, we can reserve our language to describe one or the other, and I wouldn't want to quibble about that. I mean, you can reserve certain words for actions if you want. But the point is that there's this underlying reality that was true of Adam and Eve from the beginning that led to their transgression. The transgression was indeed a willful act. That's true. But why did they choose to do that rather than not? I mean, if you've ever read C.S. Lewis, you know, Perelandra, I love that account of the green lady on the floating islands, because when the tempter comes to tempt her, her response is always just this incredibly, incredibly pure, straightforward innocence. Well, why would I want to do that? God said no, so why would I want to do that? I don't get it. I don't understand. Well, why do you not have Adam and Eve going, I don't get it, I don't understand, God said no. Instead they go, yeah, looks like a fig to me. There's something in them that the tempter was resonating with already.
How is God deciding what I do different from some other outside force deciding what I do? I mean, I'm trying to make this clear. Like, if someone grabs my arm and makes me hit someone else, how is that different from God divinely deciding from the, you know, that I'm predestined to hit someone else?
Because when God transcendently, as my sovereign creator, wills that I will be what I am, he's not coercing me into being that. He's making me to be that. He's creating me to be that.
So why is that different?
And as part of the act of creating me to be that, in conjunction with that, he's creating me to voluntarily and freely choose what I choose. He's not coercing me.
Is it different because he's on a different level from, say, the person who grabs my arm and tries and makes me hit the other person?
Yeah, the fact that he's on a different level allows him access to my being that no one on the same level has. That is, I can't jump inside of your will and create your choice for you and have it be your choice, right? all I can do is manipulate and coerce. But manipulation and coercion is such that I may be able to make you act, but I can't make it be your voluntary act. I can't do that. I don't have access to you in a way that would allow me to do that. But God, transcending this reality, living above this reality and being able to reach in from outside, has access to your will that I don't have. He can literally, from inside, if you will, create the choice that you're going to create and have it be your choice that he's creating. Have you ever read Flatland?
No, sorry.
It was, I read it decades ago, but it was a mathematician who wrote a little story about somebody from a three-dimensional world going into a world of two dimensions.
I think I've heard the analogy before with the see the fingers and the see those little circles.
Very, yeah. Very interesting. Very, I think, very enlightening. Mm-hmm. Because it does help you sort of intuitively get your mind wrapped around what would it be like to be someone who's completely outside of the reality of a world. What difference would that make? It makes a huge difference. And I think that's, God is completely outside the reality that we inhabit. Mm-hmm. He's not... That's a big one. I don't think most Christians have that conception. Most of us think of God as being my ontological peer. He's just a bigger, stronger version of me, and he lives somewhere else in the universe. And he has quick access to my life, but he's really off somewhere else. But the way you have him described by Paul is, God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. He's not my ontological peer. He's the very context that I have any existence at all. I mean, in my view, if God did not will my next breath, I wouldn't have another breath. I would pop out of existence the next second if God did not will my continuing in existence. I mean, that's how immediately, directly, and terribly in control of my life he is. But there's a good book coming out that'll discuss all that.
Is that a good book or a great book?
Actually, it's a bad book, but it's an important book, I think. It's a bad book.
Okay. No, we started on the tree. I have another question.
Okay.
It seemed to me like what you were saying is that the tree served the function of God knowing, in a sense, their decision if they were choosing good or choosing evil. But it seems to me like if they were sinners from the get-go...
Why didn't he already know that?
Well, God knows it.
Okay.
So it seems to me that it would be more of them maybe not magically knowing something new, but understanding it, almost like this was a mini-covenant...
Right.
With them.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden now they realize what transgression means.
Exactly.
And what it feels like.
Yeah, exactly right. And notice what they do. They immediately are aware of them being naked and are ashamed. Which I think is the nakedness is a sign of their having a sense of their own transparency. And now they are aware that they are sinners. They are nothing to be proud of, and so they want to cover up. They want to hide what they are now, whereas before they were not aware that they needed to hide who they were. All right, thank you.